Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to Building Better Leaders. This is Series 3. Where have we been and what have we been doing since Series 2? Well, I've been trying to sort out a lot of clutter in my life. As I've got older, I seem to have accumulated a lot. So I was just trying to really about making my life be a little bit easier. What about you, Rachel? What have you been up to?
Well, it's lovely to be back. Nice to see your face on the other side of the microphone, John. What have I been up to? I've had a baby since we last spoke on Season 2 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. Got a little boy called Remy. I had him in July, so I've been trying my best to enjoy motherhood, take a little bit of time out, get used to life as a family of five. That's including the dog.
So for those of you that have not met us in person, you'll be able to tell that I'm quite a bit older than Rachel. Here she is, adding to the complexity of her life, and I'm trying to reduce the complexity in mine. What is Series 3 all about? We've taken a different route. In Series 1, we looked at lots of things around introducing leadership, motivation, how people can influence one another. And then in Series 2, we had a lot of guests on the podcast, so we were talking to experts in their field and asking them to share their stories with us. So welcome to Season 3. Let me explain how this is going to work. This is going to be a 10-parter. This is going to be 10 podcasts, and they're going to be covering the key topics that we chat about in Building Better Leader programs. And we'll be covering the traits, the skills, and the concepts that are required really in order for you to become a better leader. So where are we going to start on this journey? The subject that we're going to look at today is going to give you an insight as to how you can better understand what makes you tick and how you can increase your own self-awareness on how you manage your expectations.
Yes, John. So if we are talking in today's podcast all about how we manage our expectations, there is a wonderful place to start, and that would be Gretchen Rubin's Four Tendency Types. So who is Gretchen Rubin, for those of you that don't know, and what does she do? Gretchen Rubin is a writer. She's an author of, I think, 6 books. Forgive me, Gretchen, if it's 7. And she's really a human researcher. She seems infinitely curious about how humans behave. And what we really love about her approach is she gives you really practical tips on how you can test your own self-awareness. Her model in the Four Tendency Types is free, which we also love. And it's something that we've intertwined on our Building Better Leaders program. I first came across Gretchen Rubin, it'd be more than 10 years ago now. I was at a place in my life where something in my mind had clicked that there must be more to life than this, and working your arse off in the corporate world wasn't quite working. And I hadn't come across coaching yet, but I was starting to ask questions and get curious as to what happiness was, and how that happiness wasn't something that happened to you, that it was maybe something you had to work on. And a very good friend of mine gave me a book called The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. And it's a gorgeous book. If you've not read it, it's a really fabulous read. And I think it was Gretchen's first book. And the book really focuses on the big question around what makes you happy. And how can you make yourself happier? And the premise of that book, The Happiness Project, is that Gretchen takes one aspect of life every month for a year, and she actively worked on, could she nudge herself towards being happier rather than chase being happy? Now, why is that relevant when we're talking about tendency types? And in all of her research, she started to come across this concept that people have a natural tendency for how they respond to and manage their own expectations. And if you understand what your tendency type is with regards to setting inner and outer expectations, you can educate and arm yourself to make yourself happier, to make yourself a better leader, to make yourself a better partner, to make yourself a better friend. And I think this is a really interesting concept. There's a lot of personal responsibility baked into it. There's a lot of curiosity baked into it about why other people are different from you, and that maybe the way you see the world isn't always the way the world is. So what we really like about this, and what this entire podcast for today really answers, is how do I respond to expectations? And if we really lean into that question and we reflect on how we respond to expectations, we can gain a lot of vital self-knowledge, self-awareness, and we can really start to understand how we can motivate ourselves better. And ultimately, it explains why we act and why we don't act. So enough on that. Let's dive into the model, what it is, what it explains, and how you can use it in management. And very interestingly, how you can also use it with your children. So we're going to kind of give you this dual sense of how you can use this model in each tendency type. So there are four tendency types, and they are upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And every single one of those is about how we respond to expectations. We'll start with the upholder. Full disclosure, I am an upholder, and upholders are able to both respond to inner and outer expectations easily and readily. People with an upholder tendency type are really quite disciplined, and I love Gretchen Rubin's mantra on this: discipline is my freedom, because they meet both inner and outer expectations.
So, Rachel, how does an upholder show up in the workplace? What sort of things should I be looking for if I have upholders in my team?
So, with meeting inner and outer expectations easily and readily, upholders are good organizational citizens in general, and they also can make really good leaders because they respond to the outer expectations well, which is deadlines, mandates from above, delivering team projects, may behave in ways that promote good organizational citizenship behaviors like role modeling values behaviors, meeting etiquette, and things like that. So that ticks that outer expectation box. But they also are really good at meeting inner expectations, which is around setting personal goals. You might find in the workplace that your upholders are very ambitious, quite keen to climb the corporate ladder, are asking and setting themselves objectives around how might I get promoted, putting the hand up to take on more projects and bigger areas where they can build their skills.
So how well do they respond to feedback if they're trying to meet their own inner expectation and outer expectations? Could there be a bit of a difficulty for them in that respect?
I think the thing, if you've got an upholder on your team, is been really aware that these people are really self-directed. They can crack on without much supervision, but they also put an immense amount of pressure on themselves. And in putting an immense amount of pressure on themselves and having very high expectations of themselves, as well as meeting others, that sometimes feedback can be. And again, please be aware we're generalizing for everyone. We're trying to make some generalizations to make it easier for you to understand. This isn't true of everybody. That they may find feedback, if it's not presented in the right way, hard to take on board because they're like, I'm doing so much and now you've been critical. And they can, in that regard, sometimes come across as quite uptight or rigid because they love a plan. They love a to-do list. They love a WIP document, a work in progress document, and for people that are of other tendencies, they can come across as quite rigid sometimes.
And what have you seen in the workplace when it comes to an upholder and their leadership styles? What sort of a challenge do they often struggle with?
It's a good question, that, John. I can't talk for everybody on this regard, but I can reflect on some of my own experiences of being an upholder in the workplace, and some of the frustrations and joys I had of it. I mean, there's one thing to be very self-directed that can be really rewarding. We often find that this tendency type goes hand in hand with somebody that's really achievement focused. So I think with upholders, they can be really, really ambitious in the workplace, and this is all about having a tendency to do it. They love goals, so obviously that's great. But I think as leaders, where they can sometimes get frustrated or with people in the teams that are upholders, is you'll find the upholder is the one that will call out if something's maybe not fair to other people. They've got the tendency type where they respond to outer expectations, so they will say yes, to doing things, but they might also be more willing to call out if something doesn't seem fair, or that if work's not distributed fairly amongst people. And I think that's sometimes where there might be a few disagreements in teams, or we'll come on to the obligers later, but I think sometimes the upholder is the obligers' spokesperson, but then they sometimes may or may feel like, oh, but why am I the one that's always putting my head above the parapet? Upholders can be a really great asset to any team. They make exceptional leaders, can become a little bit frustrated if things aren't progressing personally for them. But overall, usually we tend to find a lot of people in senior leadership roles, and particularly on C-suites of boards, being of the upholder type of person. How this might show up in children is also worth looking at. So we find that upholders, the self-directed aspect, is really evident in children, but that's more in regards to finishing their homework. These are the kind of kids that come home from school and want to do the homework first and foremost. They like order and routine and ritual. They're like, we'll do the homework first, then we can play. Get really upset if they're asked to play first when there's work that's outstanding and not been done. And that expectation from the teacher, or wanting to do well, like finishing first, second, or third in their year, is really motivating. Grades are really motivating for upholder type tendencies. And I think if you're a parent to an upholder child, you need to be really aware that they can put a lot of pressure on themselves and aren't always able to regulate rest, if there's an expectation set upon them. And that works the same for whether that expectation's set on by a coach, a teacher, a classmate, but also by themselves. And again, kids can seem quite rigid and uptight. You can get a lot of stress and upset if something happens, like you have a last minute family trip or a last minute holiday, and they're going to miss school, or they're going to not be able to get their homework done that night. And that can be really upsetting for that child.
Yeah, the thing I've noticed is that the really upholders as children really hate making mistakes. And there's always a problem with that is that we would say at Scaffold Coaching, if you learn often by trying, and sometimes we don't get everything right first time and we fail. I think the difficulty for upholders and children is they don't want to make mistakes. And therefore, we've got to be encourage them to see another way forward.
And really, really on that, explaining why it's okay to make a mistake. I think the other thing is that upholder children, and I'm reflecting on me as a child here, I really hated things that were unclear. You know, I think that the mantra that I really like for upholders is people like say, oh, you know, well, we need more spontaneity, or spontaneity is really fun. As a general rule, upholders do not find spontaneity fun. They like plans, they like to-do lists, they like to have things in order. A last minute holiday can be really stressful for an upholder. Deciding to go to a party last minute can be quite stressful for an upholder. I really didn't like untidiness or anything that fell out of a routine growing up as a child. And my dad was late for everything. And it used to be my dad never picked me up on time from anywhere. And I had a lot of dance classes and swimming, and I was always late. And it used to really, really stress me out as a child. My dad was clearly another tendency type. And so I just think we need to think about these things for upholder children, and that burnout is possible in children, and that they can take on more and more. You'll probably chuckle at this, John, but it won't surprise you. I was a straight A student, and that was for no other reason than I had the expectation on myself that if I was capable of it, I was going to get straight A's. And it didn't matter to me what my friends were doing and how much they were revising. I made an industry of revision. I had revision cards, I had schedules, I had a revision plan, and I just took myself away from the world because I wanted it so much, just to prove that I could. And that is absolutely upholder behaviour.
Yeah, so that's very self-directed, not worrying about what other people think, what other people do. You had a schedule, you had a timetable, stuck to that, and that gave you the return.
Sorry, and just on that, I'd done my mock exams, and the teachers are like, they predicted me a couple of A's and mainly B's. And I was like, the teachers have got a lower expectation on me than I think I can do. And so it wasn't even that the teachers wanted me to do it, it was the fact that I was going to prove you that I could do this, you know? And I think that's real upholder behaviour.
So that's upholders. They want to know what should be done. What is the next tendency type, Rachel? I'm going to look at questioners.
So, questioners, and this is really descriptively labelled, questioners question all expectations, and they will meet an expectation if, and it's a very big if, they think it makes sense. So, just to make it simple, let's just say questioners resist outer expectations, so what others expect, but will meet inner expectations if they can make it make sense to them. So essentially, the way to lead and work with a questioner is to try and make all expectations inner expectations. And Gretchen Rubin's mantra on this is, I'll comply if you convince me why. And I think what's interesting when you've got a questioner in your team, or you're managing a questioner, or if you work with a questioner in the workplace, it will be somebody that asks why to the nth degree. You know, they want the data, they ask why the deadline is, why it is. They want to know, well, what's the consequence if we don't meet this? Where did you get that data set for? Has anybody rigorously vetted that data? This doesn't make sense to me. Can you explain why?
So, in a meeting, those are the people who can't really move on until they understand the reasoning and the intent
Absolutely,
behind
John.
whatever's been actually suggested.
Absolutely. And I think if you are a leader or a person that's wanting to just become a better workplace citizen, and you've got that person in a meeting that keeps asking questions, that keeps circling back, please, please, please resist saying, can we park that and move on? Because these people can't move on and can't get behind it until they understand and they have made that expectation inner. And please, I cannot stress this enough, do not assume that that person, if they're a questioner, is going to leave the room and that they will do what you have asked them to do if they are not fully on board and have not fully made that request to meet an inner expectation, you will only be disappointed that they will come back. You will think that you have given them a really clear instruction, but if they haven't got behind it, they will come back and present you the work that they felt that they should have done. And I think this can be a great source of annoyance in a workplace. It can be a potential area of conflict to mine. And I think I'm thinking back about my own leadership style when I was in the corporate workplace. If you are of another tendency type, there's a bias or an inclination to sometimes find, especially in times when there's a real deadline, that it's just too hard to work with questioners. So you won't ask them to do the work because you just need it done quick and you need somebody. Look, I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. I know there's a thousand questions, but I just need you to do this. I mean, every fiber of a questioner's being is going to be literally on edge when you say, I just need you to do this, because they're like, why?
And of course, the irony with questioners is that they often don't like being questioned themselves, because they have this idea that they've thought through a lot of this and don't really want to be asked to justify their own decisions. I just find that lovely.
If you are a questioner and you're listening to this and you're like, oh gosh, is that really annoying to people? I think if you try and explain your thought process a little bit better, and just like, I know I'm asking questions, I know this might be annoying, but if you just give me 5 minutes to exhaust all my questions, I will find a way to get on board with this and work much faster down the track. And I think, especially if you've got an upholder who's like deadline focused and wanting to go, 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 just getting them to slow down and hear out your questions and giving them, give me 5 minutes to ask all these questions, can help you become a more cohesive team member.
So that's questioners in the workplace. How does it play out with your kids?
This won't surprise anyone that the big why question, but why, mummy? But why, daddy? Is the language of questioner children. Now, all kids like to ask why, but you will know if you've got a questioner child if they ask like three or four whys, you know. But why is space black? And then you say the answer. I mean, I don't even know the answer. And then they say, but why? But why is that? And there is no end to the infinite curiosity. The big thing with children that are questioners is that they need really, really robust explanations to be able to understand why you're asking them to behave the way that they are. Saying because I said so might work with other tendency types and they will conform. If you ask a questioner child, or if you say to a questioner child, look, just because I said so, you go into get a lot of resistance and probably a lot of tantruming behavior, and they won't let it go. The thing with questioner children is their persistent questioning can make them quite uncooperative and sometimes can make them seem quite disrespectful. You know, say for example, you're like, you need to do this in class. Perhaps the child's quite bright, but the rest of the class is at this level, and it's like, you need to read this book, and they're like, but I've already read that book, and you're like, read it again, because all the rest of the class are. And the question is like, well, why should I? Like, I've already read it, I can already do it, can I have a harder book? And they won't understand that everybody needs to be at the same level, because for them that makes absolutely no sense, because they're at a different level. And it's about explaining why you are doing something that's the same as everybody else when they have no desire or inclination to be at the same level of everybody else. I think some teachers really struggle with this one, to be honest. And if teachers had a better understanding of this, maybe less kids would be labelled naughty in class. It is one of my views. They can often as well, I think, find things that are asked of them in school or football training or dance lessons, pointless. Like, what's the point in me doing this? You know, you might ask them to pick up their clothes off the floor. What's the point? They're only going to go straight in the washer. Why do I have to put them in the wash basket? You know, yeah, you might actually have to explain that mum and dad like a tidy house. The reason why we put clothes in the wash basket is so everything's all together in one place. So then when we take it downstairs, we save a little bit of time. Now, I know that might seem crazy to go to that level of detail, but they need all the dots connecting for why something makes sense. So yeah,
Yeah.
that any other questions on the questioner, John?
I think everything has to be quite logical and just understood. And I think, as you say, it's taking the time when we often don't have time or we don't feel that we have time to do a little bit more explaining to a questioner than you would need to do with any of the other three tendency
Yeah.
types.
I think especially because I have got a young child, he's not a questioner, but I'm just thinking about some of the other kids that are in his football training or his martial arts classes. It's the kids that can seem uncooperative when they're asked to do something that I think you just need to lean into it and maybe have that additional conversation with the coach or the teacher or the dance teacher or whatever and say, look, my kid needs things explaining why, not just to be, you're all doing this today. And if you don't, the consequences is this, because they don't understand consequence if it's not explained why it's important to do the activity. So if that does ring true, I'd dig into this preference for sure. But let's move on. So John, why don't you talk us through how do obligers respond to expectations?
So obligers, and out of all the four tendencies, this tends to be the most prominent tendency type. So obligers meet outer expectations, but they often struggle to meet the expectations they impose on themselves. And that can sound obvious to obligers, but crazy to other people. So it's this idea that you can count on me, and I'm counting on you to count on me. Obligers will go a long way to meeting that outer expectation from you as a leader. So, giving obligers work to do, tasks to do, they will work hard on that, even maybe at the expense of their own themselves, in so much that of all the tendency types, obligers are the ones who could probably overdo it.
I think a nice example of that is if you've got obligers on your team, they're the people that you might ask, say if a last minute project comes in at work that day and you ask somebody to volunteer because it's really urgent and important, but you haven't really got chance to explain why, the obligers will be the ones that will do it and they will miss their gym class or their date that they'd got planned in with their partner. And they won't even tell you that they're missing it, but they will prioritize what you have asked them, the outer expectation, over the inner expectation that they had set for themselves, which was to go to the gym to be fitter or to spend time with their family. They will often even put work before their children, becomes quite an easy thing to do. They're known in organizations as like yes people, I suppose would be the kind of derogatory-ish term. In the literature, we'd say these people make great organisational citizens because they toe the company line really easy. If, John, you are managing a obliger or you've got a lot of obligers on your team, what are some tips that you could do to kind of protect them a little bit from burnout and to get the best out of an obliger?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that they struggle with just generally is like delegating work out to somebody else, because the expectation is on them that they sort of deliver that. So I think you've got to be aware of this particular tendency type from a leadership point of view, that you can help people with their workload, that you help them with their schedule, you remind them that part of being at work and their role also includes them looking after themselves. We talk quite a lot in the Building Better Leaders about program about the performance curve, and this is where we find people who sort of err towards the stress and the anxiety and the burnout in work. So it as a leader, it's being very aware of who these people are, and to be able to get them to take time for themselves, because that's as much as important to them and to you as a leader, and then part of your team, that they manage to function properly.
A couple of things to listen out for is, when you're asking people in your team to do it, the language of an obliger is, "Oh, I don't mind. I'll do it. I don't mind." When you're hearing words like "I don't mind," if you're the leader or you're another tendency type in that team, why don't you ask that person, "But what would you like to do? But what will this give you?" And yes, of course, organizations love obligers. This is what society is built on. Politics only works because we have a massive cohort of people that will just toe the line
It's
regardless of what
why
they think.
rules work, isn't it?
Why rules work.
Yeah.
But you must ask, what would you like to do? What's in this for you? And how can you prioritize what you want? You can have obligers in your team that will do everything and anything for the team, but then you also might be quite frustrated in them when it comes to PDR time or appraisal time, that they haven't planned for their own appraisal, that they haven't put their own personal development plan in place. And you're like, but you've got all this potential. You're the best worker on the team, and yet you can't tell me which direction you want to go in for your own development. So again, it's giving them a little bit more support, a little bit more coaching, and also not letting them do more of the work because the questioners will ask too many questions. The upholders will put what they want before or as important as what's important for the team. And we will talk about the rebel in a minute. So that's your obliger. But talk to us about how obliger children might show up, John, and some of the things that might be going on with them.
Well, with obliger children, it's how they prioritize what they have in front of them. So you may have a child who comes home from school and they've got homework to do, but they're not very well. They'll still want to crack on and do the homework, even though we're saying your teacher wouldn't expect you to do that, given the fact that you're not very well.
I think just building on that, I think it's the same with children as it is with adults. The big thing with obligers is they need external accountability. Kids that and children that have obliger tendencies need deadlines. They need a system of accountability. Reward charts work really well with obliger children, as do schedules. But again, like what you just mentioned, John, it's about explaining sometimes that you don't always have to do everything the teacher says to the nth degree if that's going to make you feel uncomfortable or be uncomfortable. The other thing that I just wanted to stress actually with obliger children is if you have got a sibling that's another tendency type, that the parents can put too much pressure on the obliger because it'll be like, oh, you make your brother do this, or you make your sister do that, or the obliger child will be, you might say, oh, tidy your room, you two. And if the child's another tendency type, why? Why should I? And they'll be like, oh, it's all right, I don't mind. And sometimes it can be really easy to lean on obligers too much, and that's a really heavy weight for a child to bear. So the parent has to take responsibility for making sure that things are equal and that workload and parental expectations are distributed fairly.
So if you're thinking about your children in your family, or you're thinking about people who you work with, perhaps this is sort of resonating with you now as to how you might be able to ask better questions or have a little bit more concern. So have a think about the people that are around you. So finally, the fourth tendency, Rachel, the rebel, will resist all expectations, outer expectations and inner alike. Their mantra is, you can't make me, and amazingly, neither can I.
I'm loving that you're a rebel, John. It's very poignant having you on this to explain this, because the rebel tendency type is the most misunderstood by the other three tendency types. I think the other three tendency types can feel quite logical to the three people that fit in those three, and you can see yourself being able to maneuver around them. I think it's the bit that's like, I get why you can't externally make you do something that. People can get that. But like, but why can't you make yourself do something that you even want to do? And I know you're laughing, John, because I find this, my life lesson of and the thing that I've, enjoyed, struggled with, found fascinating about working with you is I've had to learn how to manage you and but manage your personality, and that even if you want to do something, you won't even do it. So I've had to try and find different tactics to make you do something that I know you really want to do that will really benefit scaffold coaching. And I'm like, but why can't you just do what I ask him to do? Make that make sense to our listeners, please.
Well, you ask a good question. Why can't he just do what I ask him to do? I think it's the inference that while you're asking me to do it, it may be perceived by a rebel as being told to do it. And at that point, even though, and it does seem crazy, even though you know it'll benefit you, you can't even make yourself do that. It is fascinating. What I mean, I think that you've done really well with me in terms of getting me to do stuff in trying different methods to achieve that. But here's the point, I think, is that this has been interesting for me because I'd never realized it as something that was a thing. I didn't know about it until we looked into this many years ago, but on the basis that you know that that is really frustrating and it's really difficult for people to understand, of all the tendency types, I think the rebels have to work really hard on it themselves to see that you're really not helping your teammates, your work colleagues, because they can't understand it because it doesn't seem logical to them. What
I think you bring up a really valid point there, and I think I don't know whether Gretchen Rubin's done a service or a disservice by calling them rebels, because that word itself is loaded with assumption. But if you are a rebel, or if you think you may have somebody with a rebellious tendency type on your team, I think there's a couple of things we need to address and clear up. Number one, by nature, it won't surprise anyone that most rebels end up being entrepreneurs. Richard Branson, Stephen Bartlett, these are well-known entrepreneurs that absolutely fall into that rebel type tendency type. It doesn't mean that a rebel will throw the baby out with the bathwater and can't achieve anything. Rebels can achieve exceptional things if you can find the way to motivate them in the right way. So I think we need to resist the temptation to look at this from the side that if you're a leader or you've got rebels in your organization, that they are hard work. Yes, they take some more understanding, but if you can nail it, you can get absolutely exceptional performance out of them. That is possible. But the thing with rebels is, from my point of view, is I think number one, they tend to, if things aren't working for them in organizations, they will jump ship, they will move more, which is why they tend to prefer to be their own bosses. And that rebels that can work out how to motivate themselves can be exceptional entrepreneurs. But the thing with rebels is to really give them choices. And I think this is the core thing. If you have got a rebel on your team, it's not about asking them, well, what would you like to do? Because, we can't all do everything that we only want to do at work. But you might say, do you want to work on this project or this project? Do you want to lead on this or this? And actually, rather than saying the deadline's next Friday, so I need you to stay and work late, you say, look, I'm hearing that this might be possible to achieve this deadline by next Friday. Now, I don't know whether you can achieve that or not. Can you ever think about if you're up for it and you can do it, and let me know if it's possible? Because a rebel loves a challenge. Telling a rebel that they might not be able to do something is one way to motivate them.
Absolutely. They absolutely love a challenge. The other option you can give them, I like those two options that you gave our rebel here, but I think one of the other options you can offer them is or something that you want to do. Because often, even doing one of the other two things might fall into that category of the rebel doing the thing that they want to do. As long as it feels like it's their idea, that they've got the freedom of the choice of how they do it, when they do it, then I think you've got real strong motivation for your rebel. And I think that really works in the workplace, and I think it works equally as well with children. You have discovered, Rachel, that one of your children is a rebel.
Yes, I am an upholder, like I mentioned earlier, and my son is very similar to me. And so I made the mistake, and I'd made the mistake of making an assumption that my child would be an upholder. And so I've been kind of parenting him like he's an upholder. I've tried things like reward charts, I've tried him, he's very motivated by money. So I tried these things and it works for a certain period of time and then it stops working. And I've finally realized why. It's because our little Felix is a rebel. And I'll just tell you a story because it's the best way to describe this. He is a football fanatic. He is absolutely obsessed with football. He's 6 years old, part of a little league team, trains 3 times a week. Trying to get him to get ready for football on a Saturday morning by 8:30 to set off at 8:30 to start for 9, it had become an absolute headache in our house, and it had led to some really, really unsavoury behaviour. Just asking him to put on his football boots, you chuckle in. When I say unsavoury behaviour, I'm talking kicking, throwing things at mummy. I hate you. I don't want to go. I do want to go. I love it. Tantrums, screaming, throwing football boots down the stairs. And how the conversation would often go is, Felix, we've got to leave. Let's go. Get your football boots on. I can't do it. Can't do laces. Football boots getting thrown. Get your football boots on. We're going. Well, then that language, an obliger would buckle up, an upholder would get them on straight away. Our Felix, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not putting them on. I'm going to get in the car in my bed, in just my socks. No, you can't. Get your boots on. And then you start with the you'll let your teammates down if you don't get ready now. Everybody's waiting for you. It starts at 9 o'clock. Is it fair on your teammates? I don't care. Right. Okay. Well, that's not very nice behaviour, but he's not an upholder or an obliger. That external expectation doesn't mean anything to him. And then I'd say, well, clearly you don't like to go football. We'll miss it this week. Football, I must go. I really want to go. And then I just one day just sat down with him and I said, Felix, please get your football boots on. Why aren't you doing it? He was like, I don't know. I really want to put them on, but you're asking me to, and I can't make myself. And I was just like, wow. And just taking that moment to ask him was like, he really, really wants to do this. He really wants to go. He loves football more than anything, but he can't make himself. What we've now done is we get up and we start the conversations at 7:30 and we have to give him choices. Felix, it's football today. Are you up for being ready by 8:30? Yes or no? It's absolutely okay if you don't want to go, but are you up for it? Yes, mummy, I am. Right. Then at 7:45, we do a timer. Felix, it's 45 minutes to go. Are you going to start getting ready? It's entirely your choice. 8 o'clock, we do another time. There's this much time, Felix. Do you want to keep watching telly or do you want to get ready for football? It's now the decision, your decision. Do you want to go or not? And we have to give him timelines. The other thing that I've really, really learned is that I can't save him, and that if he isn't ready on time, I am an upholder, so I think it's not fair on the rest of the parents that we don't go. Felix don't care that if he isn't ready by 8:30, we don't save him, that we just don't set off, and he has to feel the full force of that consequence, even if it's really upset him.
Question for you, Rachel. What is your tone of voice when you're offering these choices?
Well, before I knew that, but before I'd realised it was a rebel, it was arguing, it was getting cross, it was laying all the. I'd go up, I'd go down, I'd go nurturing, I'd go. Now it's very, it's rational, it's consistent, it's a Felix, I totally get it. You might not feel like it today. The choice is entirely yours. Do you want to get in the car now and be a few minutes early where you can practice and play with your friends, or do you want to go? And then even if we've only done it once now, we have let him suffer the consequence of not going. And that's a nightmare, because then he does have a fall where children go like horizontal, stiff, become twice, triple the weight, and you hate me, and crying, and very calm. Felix, mummy loves you very much, but I've asked you 40 times about could you get ready in time. You have chosen to watch the football and on the telly rather than prioritise your own going. I gave you multiple options. I love you so much, but you weren't ready on time, and we're not going now. And just been really, really calm. And the calmer I am, the more he resists and creates. It's like he creates conflict, but then when you try and leave him, it gets worse. So I just have to sit with him and cuddle him, say, "Look, mummy loves you. I'm still here for you. We'll try again next week." But we've only had to do that once. But I really struggled with it because, I think if you are a parent and you were the questioner, a questioner mum, an upholder or an obliger, every fibre in your being wants to rescue that child because you know it would be the best thing for them and that everything will be all right once they get to football. But rebels only learn by missing out or by feeling the consequence, is my understanding. And his behaviour has been a lot better since then. And now we talk to him on a level, a lot of choices. And actually, I am touching a lot of wood here, but the last 5 times we've gone to football training, he's sat ready waiting for us because it's his choice.
It's his choice.
Now, that might sound crazy that he's a 6-year-old and we give him his choice, but that's the only way with a rebel. The other thing, John, that I think is really important to know, and this actually, I should have mentioned this earlier, this works really well for people in your team, but also for children, is really appealing to their sense of identity. So what works really well for my son is I say, "Do you think Lionel Messi or Marcus Rashford or Cristiano Ronaldo ever feel that it's acceptable to not be ready for football training on time?" And I just leave it at that. You know, if you were Cristiano Ronaldo, because you're a really good footballer, Felix, you're a really, really good footballer. Do you think that you should be ready on time for football? And he loves that identity of being labelled a really good footballer. He also loves the identity of being really helpful for mummy, which is how we engage him in the chore chart and doing things in the house. The best way to get Felix to help with the shopping is never to ask him to help with the shopping. I always say to him, "Oh, I've got a lot of bags to carry here, but it's all right, Felix. I don't think you're strong enough to help me with this." "I am. I am." And he'll carry all that shopping in all day long for you. If I asked him to carry the shopping in, he wouldn't. And I think that's the thing with people on your team as well. If you say to somebody that's a rebel, "You're the best at innovation. I think I'd really like you to lead on this because you really have a lot of skills in this area." That can work really well. You really look at things from non-conventional avenues. I think that's a real skill that we need on this project. But you're really busy. I don't know if you've got time to work on this project. Oh my God, the rebel will find time to work on this project.
Yeah, it's appealing that the association is the key factor
Absolutely. And
there.
it's influencing, you know, some people might say, is that a little bit manipulative? Manipulation influence? It's very similar.
So hopefully that's given you something to think about in terms of how you might lead your team, just looking at it from different people's perspectives and different expectations. And hopefully we've given you a few tips there that might help out when you identify which tendency type your kids are. So in summary, what do people really need from you as a leader? We're going to do leadership essentials, but just to recap very quickly on each of the different tendencies. Obligers need accountability. Upholders want to know what should be done. Questioners, they want justifications, and rebels need the freedom to do something in their own way. Our three leadership essentials are.
So, I think the first thing has got to be using Gretchen Rubin's four tendency types to increase your own self-awareness of what you are and how other people on your team or in leadership positions might see you, but also to understand about yourself how you personally respond to expectations. The second one would be to always check your own perspective and consider how you approach others. If you're, I was making the mistake of approaching parenting as an upholder, and I really needed to come at it from another tendency type. Is that something you could do as a leader? Actually, put another tendency hat on and come at something from another angle. And finally, our third leadership essentials would be really use this model as an opportunity to get curious about the people around you. Take the test, ask them to take the test. It's a little bit of fun, it's free. And get curious, try some of these things that we've suggested. Try it in your parenting, try it in your leadership style, try it in your influencing style, and see what changes. So that's our first episode of season three of Building Better Leaders. If you have found the topic that we have discussed today, we would really advocate that you read Gretchen Rubin's book on the four tendencies. If you also go to Gretchen Rubin's website, which is gretchenrubin.com, there's heaps of resources on there. Some of this is a little bit of Americanized, which is why we've taken time to do the podcast to explain this today and to put it in a British context and a leadership context. But if this is something that you're going to do with your team and you're going to take the quiz with your team, we would really, really implore you to just get curious on the subject for another 30 minutes and read some of the resources before you start sharing some of this knowledge with your team members. So go, get curious, take a look, and we will see you next month on the Building Better Leaders podcast. Thank you.
See you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.